Now, there's something very interesting about darkness. There's actually an interesting debate. Only two Jewish rabbis could have a debate like this. If you look at the verse in Genesis, it says, right, and God says, let there be light. Okay? And he called the light day, and he called the darkness night. It never says that God created darkness. So the question is darkness a separate creation? Or is darkness simply the absence of light? And the Ramban says one thing, and the Vilna Gaon says another, different rabbinic authorities. And one way of looking at that discussion is that whether evil is simply the absence of light or a separate creation is, in a way, up to us. And look at something interesting. When it talks about light, it uses the word yotzer, to form. But when it talks about darkness, it uses the word bore, to create. It should say bore or bore choshech, God creates light and darkness. It doesn't say that. It says God forms light, yotzer or and he creates. What's the difference between creation and formation? Without getting into the Kabbalistic sefirot, I'll just give you a simple way of understanding it, yeah? Right? Okay? Very interesting. If you look anywhere in the biblical creation story at the concept of yitzirah, okay, of formation is always something from something. Right? For example, vayitzer Hashem Elokim et ha'adam afar min ha'adamah. And God forms man in the second chapter of Genesis from the dust of the earth. In other words, there was already earth, and God transformed that earth into man. All sorts of ethical messages there, that we come from dirt. Remember, as great as you think you are, you come from dirt. And we all come from the same dirt. All sorts of messages. But formation means something from something. Creation? Creation is ex nihilo. Creation is something from nothing. Now, why is darkness something from nothing, whereas light is something from something? This is so beautiful. You know, if the forces of darkness and light were balanced, were even, we would have a tough time. One of the greatest gifts God gives us is that it's much easier to pursue the path of light. If you take the path of light, you've got a head start. Because Hashem puts in me the ability, light comes from somewhere. You know where light comes from? This brings us back to the concept of tefillah. I want to read you one of the most beautiful paragraphs I have ever read. It's the beginning of the introduction of Rav Kook, who was the first chief rabbi of Israel, to the Siddur. It's called the Olat Hariyah. It is a magnificent book. I don't know if it's been translated yet. I can tell you that it will be. Listen to this line. Hatfilah hamatmedet shel haneshama. The constant tefillah, prayer, but we call it tefillah, right? Of the soul, mitametzet hi tamid latzet min ha'elem el hagilui, is constantly struggling to come out from the hidden to the revealed. See, we have this perception that three times a day we decide to daven, to pray, but that's not true. Our soul is constantly trying to pray. It's just that we get in the way. Okay? Now, what do I mean when I say our soul? Well, that's also an amazing chapter in Endless Lights called Me, Myself, and I. There are copies around it. If you haven't read this, really, I highly urge you to read this. But it's an interesting discussion that we have with ourselves. You know, you talk to yourself. Who's talking to who? Who's the subject? Who's the object? A very interesting question. So the soul, right, is who I really am. And the me that's talking to the soul is the character that I play. So what Rav Kook is saying, okay, is that part of me, you know, it's like, I'll give you an example. One of the challenges that atheism has, I don't believe personally you can prove that God exists. I think you can know that God exists. There are many things we know we can't prove. And therefore, I don't think that challenges, logical or theological, that an atheist has, prove that an atheist is wrong, right? It's just not the path I've chosen. But one of the challenges, any atheistic philosophy, theology writings that you read, Bertrand Russell, Sartre, all struggle with this question. If there is no God, if there is no objective authority, how can ethics ever be objective? How can you ever have an objective moral ethic? How can anything ever be right just because objectively it's right? Bertrand Russell once wrote, to believe that cruelty is only wrong because I don't like it is to believe the absurd. He was a self-proclaimed atheist, but he struggled with this. Right? In other words, I don't know, your children want to play soccer. And, you know, you don't have a soccer ball. So what's the problem? You go outside, you find a cat in the old city. You're doing everybody a favor. You rip off its head, you give it to your children, they play soccer. So that's horrible. Why is that horrible? Is it horrible because I think it's horrible? Or is it horrible because objectively that's just wrong? So if God exists, and God creates the world, and there is an objective right and wrong, then something is wrong because Hashem tells me it's wrong. I don't steal, not because I think it's wrong to steal. I don't steal because I believe Hashem is telling me not to steal. But if there is no God, how do you have an objective ethic? So you know what the atheist will answer? Part of the makeup of the human being is that we instinctively know what's right and wrong. And I would agree with the atheist. Except that I call that the neshama. That's the part inside of me that's tapped into that same objective ethic. My soul is what's called in Hebrew a chelek eloka mimal, a part of Hashem. And I can tap into God inside of myself. Not physically inside of myself, but as a part of my own experience. And that soul is constantly trying to struggle. That soul constantly wants good. And when we get in the way, because we're deep in the world of chomer, of materialism, and the world of the earth, and all the other things that mess us up, we should know that at our core is light. Light is formed. Light comes from somewhere. And therefore, it has a root, it has a base, it has a source, and that also is a gift. All I have to do to find the right way in life, in all the things that we do, is to try to get back to the source. To try to discover the light within me. And it is that struggle, it is that journey, that is the beginning of the road to the Shema. Okay? Okay. Now we're going to get to the Shema. Questions? This is a lot to think about. Yes? Pardon? What Rav Kook said is don't think that it's that you take time to pray in the morning and you take time to pray in the afternoon. Know that your soul is constantly yearning to pray. And that what you're really trying to do is to get out of the way. To release the part of you that wants to pray. By the way, this is not just true about prayer. This is true about all spirituality. In a marriage, right? Don't think that you make a decision on a Monday morning to love your husband. How do you make that decision? Sometimes you make that decision by buying him a present, and sometimes you make the decision by making him breakfast, and sometimes you make the decision by allowing him the privilege of making you breakfast in bed. I think that's important, and we can discuss that later. Okay, right? But that's not because three times a day you decide to love your husband. That's because you're constantly loving your husband. You constantly want to love your husband, but you're not always conscious of it. And the more you get out of the way and allow that to become realized, the more wonderful a relationship you'll have and the more wonderful a life you'll have, and this is true for everything. Make sense? Okay. First of all, now we get into the realm of opinion, and there are also different pieces of the Siddur, of the prayer. I don't personally think that there are extra words in the Siddur. I think that even goes to the section of the Siddur that dates back to Talmudic times. There are debates about this, but that's my opinion. By the way, one of the ways that you can intuit this is in the world of numbers. Numbers are very, very significant. And we're going to get a chance to talk about numbers, I think, a little bit on Sunday. The number 6, the number 7, the number 10, the number 40. Do you ever wonder why the Jews were 40 years in the desert? Moshe was 40 days on Sinai. Noah had, 40 days of the flood. That's not accidental. There's a connection between those ideas that comes through a particular number. Which is no big shakes if, that the Torah comes from Hashem. If human beings wrote it, and if biblical criticism would be correct and they wrote it at different times, that would be amazing that they could come up with the same, but okay. So, in the Torah you find patterns of 6, 7s, and 8s all the time. 6 is always incomplete. Something's always missing. 6 days of the week, still missing Shabbat. If you look at the way the Christians set up the Bible, because they controlled the printing press, they end chapter 1 at the end of the 6th day. And God saw everything He created and it was good. And then it says He rested. That's a new paragraph. Judaism ends chapter 1 after Shabbat. Because Shabbat is not after creation. Shabbat is the 7th day of creation. On the 7th day, God created Shabbat. Okay? 7 is always completion within nature. And 8, by the way, is me'ala teva, me'ala zman, above nature and above time. Anytime you find numbers, they intuit you to an idea. For example, when you look in the Torah, I'll give you one quick example. The story of Noah. You can break down the entire story of Noah into 7 stories, 7 units. In each of those 7 units, the name Noah appears 7 times. This is not, by the way, codes. This is just pshat. This is just what you find in the Torah, right? In the last story of Noah, Noah gets out of the flood. He gets out of the ark. He plants a vineyard. It all starts good. But then he drinks from the vines, right? The wine. He gets drunk. His sons end up finding him naked. End of the story of Noah. Noah might well have been supposed to have been the first Jew. He was the second Adam, right? I mean, the whole world descended from him. And Noah could have created a whole different world, but Noah got drunk. And in that story, Noah loses the chance to be Noah. You want to know how many times the name Noah appears in the last story of Noah? Six times. Interesting. And you find this all over the Torah if you're curious about this, cover me at lunch. In the Siddur, I also find significance in numbers. The number that you find, there are two numbers you find most often in the Siddur, the number 18 and the number 26. Words repeat themselves in forms of 18 and 26. 18 is Chai. The word Chai, Chet Yud, is the 8th and the 10th letter of the alphabet. And 26 is the name of God. The Yud, the He, the Vav, and the He comes out to 26, the 6th letter and the 5th letter twice, right? Okay? So because of those and many other reasons, I do think that each word is significant because it's created as a pattern, right? Okay.
The reason why darkness does not is because it's not Hashem.
No. No. That exactly is going to be the answer to this question. What is Uvoreta Kol? What is in God creates everything? This is a very important idea, which I wasn't going to get to, but since you asked the question, how do I deal with darkness? Is darkness negative? Is darkness positive? Sometimes in our darkest moments, we find our greatest strengths. Right? The verse says, "Lagid baboker chazdecha." In the morning, I sing your praise. Right? Ve'emunatcha balelot. But the faith of you is in the night. Night represents faith. Because in the darkness, when I can't see that God is there, know that God is there. So the gift of darkness almost is faith. It's very interesting. Now, and we're going to talk about this when we get to the Shema, because the third letter of the Shema, the Ayin, represents era of the evening. So, darkness, really, is up to us. Whether we turn darkness into a gift or a curse is up to us. That does not mean, by the way, that I have the arrogance to go sit with someone who, God forbid, I don't know, their wife is dying of cancer, and say to them, oh, this is a great opportunity to grow. And don't get carried away with this idea. But I think when we deal with the darkness that we have in our own lives, we can transform darkness into journeys into light. You could make a case for saying that if there was no darkness, we wouldn't appreciate light. So darkness is the intangible, and that's why the end of this blessing is Vorei Kol. At the end of the day, everything comes from God. When you're finished with your journey of giving and partnership, and you've done so much to give, then, and only then, it's time to remember that that's all an illusion, that it really all comes from God. You know what it's like? I'll give you an example. Money. Money is a great example. Chafetz Chaim, I personally really believe this. Chafetz Chaim says, Chafetz Chaim is one of the great rabbis 100 years ago, probably the greatest of his generation, and there aren't that many rabbis you can say that about in Jewish history. The Chafetz Chaim suggests, based on the Talmud, that Ma'otav shel Adam k'tzuvin lo, that a person's money is set for him on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. In other words, this past Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, it was determined how much each of us is going to earn, how much we're going to give, everything to do with money. Okay. So if that's true, then why work? Right? Why work? So I'm not going to go back to the discussion of yesterday, right? But I'll tell you how I look at this. Let's say you've got this amazing project. You want to build, I don't know, an orphanage in your neighborhood. Or you want to build a synagogue, whatever it might be. Okay? And you realize you have to raise $1 million to build this orphanage, to build a synagogue. And you know that building this orphanage is a tremendous mitzvah. But you have to go raise $1 million. That's a lot of work. So you go donor after donor, right? And some of them help you and some of them don't. So you think, okay, when you walk out of a donor office and he gives you, I don't know, $50,000, you feel so great. But when you walk into a donor's office and he says, look, I'm really sorry, I can't help you at all, you feel terrible, right? No, that's ridiculous. Before you walk into someone's office, if you really understand that it's a gift from God, that doesn't mean that you don't walk into the office. Because Hashem, part of that gift, has given you the privilege to be a vehicle. You know, it's like God's putting on a play. And no matter how big a star you are, if you get sick the day before a play, they're going to find someone else because the play is going to go on. Right? The graveyard is full of irreplaceable people. You get to decide what role you play in the performance. Right? Do you want to be the Benny Friedman or the Chester Meisel or the Jonah that you can be? That's up to you. So there's this project. Now this project is either meant to happen or it's not meant to happen. To be so arrogant as to think that this project totally depends on you, that's ridiculous. But to recognize what a gift it is that Hashem blesses you to be a vehicle, to have the privilege to be part of bringing that project to the world, that's awesome. Now you're doing something else that's awesome. Because for whatever reason, Hashem has determined that there's a person standing in front of you who has the opportunity to share that privilege, to be part of that journey. Now, if you walk out of his door, and for whatever reason Hashem decided, or he decided, or whatever, that he's not going to be part of that journey, that's okay. How do you know that he's meant to be? Maybe the reason you met him has nothing to do with this orphanage. Maybe the orphanage was the excuse so that you could meet him for some totally different reason. And that balance is the balance between light and darkness. To recognize that it's all a gift, that it all comes to you. No, first of all, they're two psukim,
okay?
But the question still stands, because why didn't we choose that verse, right? The verse that ends uvorei tara, right? And one opinion, I mean, we could get into a long discussion if you want to run. One opinion is that when we say yotzero uvorei choshech, the choshech represents ra, and therefore it's already in the tefillah. But it's a good question, right? And what's the difference between ra and choshech, etc.? But let me just start, you'll come to me afterwards, because I want to get to the Shema, right? So let's talk about the Shema, okay? One thing to note, we're not going to talk about this, but I can't not pass this by. Just note, we're about to talk about Shema, and then hopefully we're going to talk a little bit about the first verse of Ve'ahavta. Interesting that the last blessing that precedes the Shema is Ahavat Olam. Now what's Ahavat Olam? Ahavat Olam is a love for the world. Not a love for each other, not a love only for Jews, a love for the world. The last stage of the journey to arriving at Shema is to love everyone. To recognize that all love is a part of a greater love, which is the whole world. Judaism has never been just about the Jewish people. Whenever Judaism is about the Jewish people, it's because the Jewish people are a vehicle to be about the whole world. But it's not because that's where it stops. And if anybody's curious about that discussion, you can also come over to me. So now we get to the Shema. Alright, so what is this? Shema. Why is it that the journey is through the Shema? So before I get there, and we're finally almost there, we need to understand this verse, okay? What is it that Israel is being asked to hear? Hear, O Israel, Shema Israel. We're being asked to hear, and this is, there are many different ways to interpret this verse, so I'm choosing one. We're being asked to hear Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. Okay? Now, in order to understand this, Hashem is one name of God. Elokim is another name of God. There are many names of God. So Hashem, who is our Elohim, who is Hashem, is one. So before we can understand this, we now gotta know the difference between Hashem and Elohim, right? So what's the difference between Hashem and Elohim? So this is really prima facie Rav Soloveitchik, and you'll find this in many different spaces. Rav Soloveitchik points out something which is fascinating. He says that the four most important words in Judaism are Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu, the beginning of every blessing. What does it mean, Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu? The word Hashem, okay, which is the Yud, the He, the Vav, and the He, okay, is one name of God. And it's very different from the name Elohim, okay, which is really pronounced Elohim, except that we don't pronounce it unless it's part of a full verse, or part of prayer. So I keep saying Elohim, but really, technically, when you're saying a prayer, it's pronounced Elohim. Just like the word the Yud, the He, and the Vav, and the He, even though we don't know exactly how it's pronounced anymore, when you're saying a tefillah, you actually say the word Adonai, right, which is Adnut, which is that Hashem is the Adon, right? But we pronounce it Hashem, okay? So what is this, you know, the Christians call it like Yahweh or all sorts of, because that's sort of close to how the vowels sound. So it's interesting, in the Adon Olam, you know, we say, you know, that Hashem is the Hayah, Hashem was, Hoveh, Hashem is, and Yihyeh, Hashem will be. That's very easy to say. It's very hard to understand. How do I relate to something or some that was, is, and will be? What does that mean? So Hashem, so even though I think that I davened at my bar mitzvah at the Kotel to God, you know, some 30 years ago, I'm actually still davening and God's still there? How does that work? In fact, when you really start to delve into that concept, that Hashem was, is, and will be, you realize that the root of was, is, and will be, which is being, hoveh, to be, is the same as the name of God. In fact, when Moshe talks to God and says, what do I tell the Jewish people? Who are you? Who's sending me? God says, ehyeh asher ehyeh. I will be that I will be, right? That's what God says. And in fact, I once heard, Rav Kook has a long chapter on this. It's very difficult stuff, but Rabbi Aaron was once I think, many times, having discussions on this topic. And I like the way he put this. He said, you know, if you're a writer, so writing is not who you are. Writing is what you do. A writer is who you are, right? And if you're a dancer, dancing is not who you are. Dancing is what you do. A dancer is who you are. And the dancer does a lot of dancing. So what are we called? We're called human beings. So the being is not the essence of the reality. The beer would be the essence of the reality. We are beings. We are extensions of the true reality, which is Hashem. We're created by Hashem, and we're part of Hashem. And everything is an extension of that reality. And I want you to know that if you're sitting here right now and you're thinking about this and saying, whoa, on your lunch break, that's exactly how you should feel. Because this is too much to comprehend. You know, there's a tremendous danger to teaching anything, and I think it's especially true for these topics. You actually start to teach this, you start to talk about this, and you think you're there. Hey, I can talk about God, so I must have a great relationship with God. It's very dangerous, because it's not true. Just because you can describe something doesn't mean you're there. This is a tremendous amount of work, and I don't think you ever get there. This is overwhelming. It is overwhelming to contemplate a relationship with a being that is everything and ever was and ever will be beyond my comprehension. That's the concept of Hashem. You know how I feel when I stand before Hashem? I feel like nothing. I feel so small. I'm in awe of Hashem. And that's not a negative feeling. Sometimes that's a beautiful feeling. To stand, you know, some of us went to visit, what did we go to the other day? You stand on the roof here. You stand on the roof here, and you're looking out at 3,000 years of history. 3,000 years! Hundreds of generations of Jews. And you're looking at this, and that's just overwhelming. And you have to be in awe at the idea that after 2,000 years of dreaming, the Jewish people have come home, and we get to be here. That's unbelievable. And you feel so little in the river of human history. But that's a dangerous thing also. Because when you feel that small, you become nothing. And God doesn't want me to be nothing. So then you have the word Elohim. Now the word Elohim, that's a whole different word. In fact, where do I find the word Elohim? I find the word Elohim by Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. In fact, when God speaks to Moshe, God says, right? Vayra, right? Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, Bekel Shaddai. I appear to Avram, Yitzchak, and Abraham as an Elohim. Ushmi Hashem lo nodati lahem, but I didn't talk to them about Hashem. And what does that mean? Elohim is everything that Hashem is not. Now don't misunderstand this. This doesn't mean that there's two gods. It doesn't mean there's two aspects of God. We can't understand that God can be both these things at the same time. So the Torah talks in a language that we can understand. But this is one way of looking at our relationship with God. Elohim is that name of God that allows me to have a relationship with God. In fact, it's interesting that the hey and the kuf interrelate to each other. It's not accidental that in order not to say Elohim, we say Elohim. We could have said Elodim or Elobim. Why do we say Elohim? Because the kuf and the hey, there's a theological underpinning there. And Elohim means kel kayam, that God is alive for me. Something that's kayam, that exists in my life, is something that I have a relationship with. You know where you really see this? You see this in the Ten Commandments. God comes to the Jewish people, and according to the Torah, actually Hashem speaks to us. This is the only time God speaks to the entire Jewish people without Moshe in the middle. And God speaks to the Jewish people and God says, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am the Lord your God. And all the rabbis point out, you know, how could you say Elokecha, your God, the individual? It should say Elokechem, plural. God's talking to the whole Jewish people at Sinai. Hundreds of thousands, millions of people, if you throw in Kabbalah, every soul that ever was and will be, I mean, Billy, who knows? So why doesn't God say, Ani Hashem Elokechem? And the answer is such a beautiful response. Because when Hashem spoke to us, when Elohim spoke to us at Sinai, we were given the experience, the feeling, that God was talking only to us. Now we don't have the capability of doing that, much less understanding it. But God is able to talk to every individual and to give them the perception that that conversation is a personal, unique conversation. It's not even a conversation, I don't know what to call it, but you know what I mean. And we know the difference in real life. We know the difference between sitting, you know, you could be listening to, I don't know, President Bush speak. And you could be listening to him say the same words, but you could be sitting in the Oval Office, just the two of you. Or you could be sitting on the lawn in front of the White House with 100,000 people. It's not the same experience. Hashem gave every individual that experience of being there, that in this moment, have you ever been in an audience and a speaker is speaking and there's such a, whatever, charismatic, powerful, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, whatever it might be. The Lubavitcher Rebbe actually had this gift. Anybody here ever meet the Lubavitcher Rebbe? Anybody? No? Yeah? Okay, so then you know what I'm talking about. The Lubavitcher Rebbe had eyes. His eyes were unbelievable. The eyes are the window, they're the mirror to the soul. You looked at the Lubavitcher Rebbe and you were a little overwhelmed. I remember once I was at a Fabrengen, which is on a Saturday night, there was actually Simchas Torah, and hundreds, thousands of people come, and they sing, and they dance, and they sit, and it's a tish, and he sits at a table. And at one point in the Fabrengen, and this he does it every, he did it every Fabrengen, right? He drinks a L'chaim. And before he drinks a L'chaim, while they're singing, everybody in the room is given a little cup of L'chaim. Right? A little bit of whatever, vodka, whatever it was, I don't know. Gets really happy after that. And then he does the most incredible thing. He takes his cup, and he starts to go around the room. And he does this to every single person in the room. He looks at each person, lifts his glass, and the person, suddenly realizes the Lubavitcher Rebbe is looking at them, lifts his glass back, then he goes to the next person, and the next person. And everybody's singing, but it gets quieter, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe is now making contact with every single person in the room. And I remember, and I don't know whether this is psychological or real, it's totally irrelevant to me, because it was an incredible experience, all of a sudden you realize it's getting close to you, and it's like this energy is coming your way. And then he's doing it to the person next to you, and you actually get a little, it's like, whoa. And then he looks at you. And in that instant, it's just you and the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and you get the distinct impression that this man just knows. He just gets it. There's something going on here. This is not like a trick. There's something incredible. I want you to know you feel this incredible sense of love that this person, and I understand why Chabad Hasidim became so enamored of the Rebbe, because he had a gift. So multiply that by who knows how much. Hashem gave everybody that experience at Sinai. And what was Hashem basically saying to each Jew? Anochi Hashem Elokecha Asher Hotzeiticha Me'aretz Mitzrayim. I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt. And that's the introduction, the beginning of the Ten Commandments. And the big question is, why does God say, I'm God who took you out of Egypt? They just got out of Egypt. If you're a Jew, I mean, we could debate whether God took us out of Egypt, but if you're a Jew sitting at Sinai, and you just saw the sea split 3 months ago, you know God took you out of Egypt. And if God, well, God needs a resume. And if already God is going to use a resume, what's the most impressive detail on God's resume? God created the world. Right? I mean, that's the big one. So why doesn't God say I created the world? Because that wasn't the point Hashem was trying to make. Hashem is telling each of us, you know what you just saw? I want you to know that everything I did, the Exodus from Egypt, the 10 plagues, the splitting of the sea, bringing you to this place in this moment, I did all of this for you. And the reason I did all of this for you was because I love you. In other words, at Sinai, Hashem introduces the concept of a God that cares. That's such a powerful idea. Because if Hashem cares about me, and how could Hashem not care about me? Hashem created me, of course Hashem cares about me. It's amazing to me that the concept of Hashem loving me is such a unique concept. Why would Hashem not love what Hashem created? If Hashem didn't love me, why would He create me? And that's the word Elohim. Elohim means that I can have a personal relationship with God. What is the blessing? Baruch atah, you, in the second person, as opposed to who, about whom we speak. You know, you feel this, in English you lose this, in Yiddish you feel this. You know, in Yiddish you say, Vusmach du, how are you, second person, where I talk to you. And then you say, Vusmach dir, and how is he? So how is the rabbi today? How is the doctor today? It used to be that you would speak about a person to their face as a sign of respect. So we don't say Baruch Elokeinu, blessed is our God. We say Baruch Atah. It's the difference between saying, and so how is Michael feeling today? And saying, hey, Mikey, buddy, right? That's a different world. We have the audacity to believe, you know, what do we call our Shemona Esrei, which we're going to talk about on Sunday? What do we talk about? We call this the Amidah. Have you ever heard that phrase, the Amidah? Do you ever wonder why the highest form of our meditation is standing? And the rest of the world, when they meditate, what do? They go down. They sit. They connect to the earth from whence we came. And that makes a lot of sense. So how come we stand? We have the audacity to believe that we can stand before Hashem. That we can be in a partnership with God. That we can be almost on an equal level. That's magnificent. But it's also very dangerous. Because sometimes I become so familiar with God, I become so convinced that I'm the partner, I forget that I'm a junior partner. It's me and God hanging out on the street corner, and you know, and we're singing Kaulbach songs, and hey God, baby, I love you. You know, there's something you gotta remember that it's still God. So then I remember that Hashem is Hashem. But sometimes I get so into the name Hashem that I lose sight of the fact that I can have a relationship with Hashem. That I'm not really nothing, even though I am nothing. So then it's Elokeinu. You see this at the beginning of Shemoneh Esrei. What do we do at the beginning of Shemoneh Esrei? Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu. So what do we do? Baruch, the bracha, the blessing. I'm bringing God into the world. I bend my knees. I'm flexible. I'm allowing God in. Atah, personal relationship. So close, it's almost me and God on the street corner. So I bow down. Remember that you should be in awe. And then I get to the word Hashem, which is that I'm in awe of God. But I don't want to be so in awe that I become nothing. So I stand up. And that's the balance between Hashem and Elohim. Which brings us back to the Shema. I want you to know that Hashem is also Elokeinu. And Elokeinu is also Hashem. I also want you to know that there's a difference between Hashem and the way I relate and am in awe to God before I discover that Hashem is Elohim. Before I discover that God can have a personal relationship with me. And the Hashem that I have awe for after I discover that I can have a personal relationship. You know what's really powerful? Sometimes you're in awe of someone, you know? You see this with couples. We're brought up in a Hollywood society. And we have all these illusions, many of which are very negative, and we don't even realize how they influence us. You meet people who are just waiting for the music, you know? And that's not really how love works. So you meet a girl and you're in awe of her. Maybe you're in awe of her for the right reasons, maybe for the wrong reasons, but you're in awe of her. You know, one of the most dangerous types of relationships is when a student marries a Rebbe. I've been involved in a couple of these situations. Because your husband can't be your Rebbe. Not a healthy thing, right? So whenever, only twice, but on two occasions I've had an instance where a Rebbe, you know, was teaching Torah and fell in love with a student in a healthy way, Baruch Hashem. I mean, you know, both adults. And the student fell in love with the Rebbe and they're developing a relationship. And usually you get into certain challenges. And because one of them or both of them happened to be students of mine, so I got involved in this discussion, right? And I remember one particular fellow. And as soon as I spent an hour with this couple, I knew that this couple was meant to get married. This couple was absolutely doing the right thing. And they're married today and they have four children. It's tremendous. But they needed to break through a wall because he needed not to be her Rebbe. She needed to let go of him being the teacher and he needed to let go of her being the student because that's not what a marriage is. Right? So you're in awe of someone and then you marry them. And then you find out they leave the toilet seat up. So you're not so in awe of them anymore. But sometimes you're blessed enough that when you get to know them better, you discover all the reasons that you want to have a relationship with them and you discover that you're not in awe of them. But as you get to know them and develop that relationship, you discover a whole different level of awe. Because this awe is real. This awe is an awe based on relationship. This is the person that you discover who has a heart of gold, not because an hour a week when he's on television he has a heart of gold, because he really is a heart of gold. That's a whole different level of awe. And all of this, Hashem, Elokeinu Hashem, the different ways I relate to God, the different ways God relates to me, they're all one. Which leads us to what one is. You see, we look at the number one as the first number. But that's not the one that we're talking about here. Right? For example, you know, you've got this one. This one cup. And it's before the other cups. And when I take this one cup and I put it on these cups, they're all cups. And this is the first. But this one is a definable one. There's something before the one and after the one. That's not the one we're talking about. The one we're talking about, right, is the one that's not even a number. This is the one before there were numbers. This is beyond number. This is the one that is everything. Now, how do you tap into that one? I'll give you one good example, okay? That's the oneness of love. You know what happens when you really love someone, you know? You stop being other and you become one. This relates back to one of the questions we had yesterday. God puts us in the Garden of Eden. Tells us not to eat from the tree. What happens? We eat from the tree. He knows we're going to eat from the tree, so we get kicked out. It's not exactly correct. We actually get kicked out after God asks us why we ate from the tree, and man says, the woman made me. That was a big mistake. Right? And that's a whole discussion. But bottom line, we came, we ate, we had to leave. So we asked yesterday, so why did God put us there? The verse says, Vayitzer Elokim et Adam, and God formed man. Zachar u'nekeva Abraham, God created male and female. So the Medrash, and really the Kabbalah, describes this verse, and says originally, Human beings were created as an androgynous being, as a male, female, a he, she, he being. Okay? And if you wanted to picture this physically, it would be something like this. Right? It would be, right? This is the, right? This is the, right? The male, this is the female. We're like two, looks like a ghost, right? What can I tell you? Right? Okay? We're two beings. And we're going this way, and we're going this way, right? Okay? And we're one. We're two others that are really one. And then it says, Lo tov hayot adam levado. It's not good for man to be alone. So God does something called nisira. In modern Hebrew, nisira is to saw. Right? To saw with a saw. But in Kabbalistic language, what it means is that Hashem separates us. So Hashem created other. Right? Vayitzer, formed. Not a new creation, a formation. Not that a woman was taken from man, but we were separated. And the Kabbalah suggests that because we were once one, now that we're other, we yearn to come back to that initial one. And that's how we know what it is we're looking for. We're looking to find what mystically, on some level, we once had. And that's the paradigm of creation. Hashem puts us in the Garden of Eden so that we will experience oneness. And then we have to leave the Garden of Eden because that oneness does not have value because it was given to us. We didn't earn it. And now we have to find it again. But how do we know what we're looking for? We know what we're looking for because we've experienced it. This is the same as the legend in the Talmud of the angel that teaches Torah to the baby in the womb. And then when the baby gets out of the womb, so the baby is made to forget all the Torah that he or she learned from the angel, right? And the angel says here, and whatever. It's a long discussion. So then why did the angel teach it to me? So that I would have the instinctive sense that I've been there before. And by the way, when you study Torah, you actually experience this. You learn something, you learn it for the first time, you come up with an idea, you just have this feeling that this is familiar. I'm looking to recapture it. That's oneness. That's a whole different level of oneness. Oneness, right, is where everything is together. It's not that there's you and there's me, it's that we're one. We're connected. And the only way to achieve that oneness is to bring Hashem into the world. Because Hashem is the source of all oneness. And that's what we say when we're saying Shema. And now we can get back to the concept of Shema. So why is it then that the vehicle to this is through the ear, is through listening? So, there are many ways to discuss this, but I'll give you one quick idea. And I'll tell you how I came to this. It took me a long time to understand that when people ask you questions, they're not always looking for answers. You know, a lot of people, you know, they have a question and they want the answer, and what's the answer, and did you find the answer? And I'm not sure there always is an answer. There's my answer, there's your answer. Sometimes it's okay to have questions. Maybe questions don't need answers. Maybe you just need to be okay with the questions. It took me a long time to understand. Students don't always ask you questions. And by the way, not just students, right? Your wife, your children. You know what the most single valuable word in human relations is? As a parent, as a spouse? Ready for this? This is a deep word. Ready for this? Very valuable word. My wife once got me a present. She bought me a book. The book was called, you all know this book, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. If your wife buys you this book, you read it. So I'm reading this book. It was actually an interesting book. I wasn't sure whether she bought me the book because she thought it would be interesting for some of my classes or because she was giving me this little message there. But okay. So he has a whole chapter in there, which is, you know, you find this in Judaism, but he writes it very well. Talks about the fact that, you know, men like to fix things and women like to do this and men like to do that. And he gives an example. And his example is, you know, you come home at the end of the day and your wife comes up at the end of the day. She starts telling you what happened at work, right? And so you want to fix it. So she says, you know, and I went in and the boss and this colleague and they said this. And so you say, oh, well, why don't you try this and why don't you try that? And the wife gets all annoyed at you. Why? Because she says, why don't you listen? And you say, well, I am listening. I'm listening so well I can even give you an answer. I didn't ask you for an answer. I just asked you for listen. So he writes this paragraph, he says, understand your wife is not sharing this with you so that you can fix it. Your wife is sharing this with you so that she can share with you. Okay. So I thought, that's a good idea. I gotta try this. Alright, maybe it's true. Because we would get into these little pleasant discussions in the evening. So, you know, a little while later, my wife comes home one day, she starts sharing me everything happened at work. Right? Everything happened at work. This and that, blah, 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 blah. And I'm sitting there the whole time, right? And I'm saying, yeah, really? And this goes on for about an hour, and then we finish the discussion, and she stands up and says, you know, that was a great discussion. You do this with your children, right? Your children come home, they've got a problem, right? This kid hit me because it took my ice cream, so what do? You want to fix it. So you give them the answer. But when you give them the answer, you're not letting them get the answer. So you know what's fascinating? When you don't give them the answer, when you just, right? Oh, she hit you, huh? Ooh. Must have hurt. Ooh. Yeah. And I told her something too. Ooh. 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 And then it takes them about 5. How about you think I should go say I'm sorry? Right? And inevitably, they will always come up with a solution. And very often, we're put in this world not to give the answers, to be the listeners. We have to learn how to listen. This is something our generation needs to learn. We need to learn how to listen. And what's interesting is, just like the soul that Rav Kook was describing, many people, they talk about finding things. I want to find the person I'm looking for. It's an interesting error that people make. You're not really looking for the right person. You're looking to become the right person. When you become the right person, then the right person finds you. And you're not looking for Hashem either, because Hashem's everywhere. You're just trying to figure out how to let Hashem in. Now, there's a big difference between seeing and hearing, right? If you think about the 5 senses, the sense which involves the least amount of choice is listening. I choose to look here or I look there. If I'm looking there, I'm not looking there. But listening, I'm doing all the time. I actually have to make a choice not to listen. So all I have to do to listen is to let go. Just allow it in. And that's exactly what we're talking about. Now, this could get a lot deeper. Because listening is the vehicle, right, by which I learn to see where God really is. You know, it's interesting. Torah doesn't tell me where to find God, except it alludes to it in one instance. And it says that every human being is created in the image of God. Now, if every human being is created in the image of God, whatever that means, it means that there's a little bit of Hashem in every human being. If I can't see Hashem in the person sitting next to me, I'll never find Hashem anywhere else. So how do I find Hashem in the person sitting next to me? I just have to learn to listen. Because when people speak to you, there's a little bit of godliness coming with everything that they say. And things speak to you in different ways. People speak with words, they speak with actions, they speak with emotions. Nature speaks. We're listening to things. And just by way of example, take 30 seconds. Let's just stop. Stop everything you're doing and just listen. Just listen. So it's interesting that when we do that, we think we're stopping, so it's quiet. But it's not quiet. It's just that now we're hearing what's there all the time. You know, I saw this in the Army. In the Army, they teach you a whole different mode of fighting and walking at night because sound travels farther at night because there's less activity. So there are less things to prevent the sound waves from traveling. So you can hear at night in ways that you can't hear in the day. That's a fact. Okay? They teach you a whole system of night walking, for example. You have to be much quieter at night because the sound of your footsteps travels farther. Now, if you take that back to what we were saying before, when we began, that Choshech represents darkness, represents faith, represents the times in our life of darkness. So even though it's dark, sound travels a lot farther. In the darkest moments, you can't see, but you can always hear. So there's a lot more to this discussion. I'll finish with one last thought. Right? Which is that once we get the Shema, and we get that it's all one, and we get that the difficulty and the joy, the light and the darkness, the relationship with God and the awe of God are all one, then we're ready to start figuring out how to put that into our lives. How do we get there? What is the first paragraph of the Shema? V'ahavta. V'ahavta. To love, and you shall love. That's an amazing mitzvah. We are actually commanded to love. How do you love? You either love something, you go to the movies, you watch TV, you listen to poetry. Everybody thinks that love is just something that comes, right? You know, you find love. Finding something means it's just like you didn't earn it, you found it. Oh, look, I found a wallet. I found love. There's love somewhere. I'm just looking for it, right? That's not how Judaism views love. Love is something that you have to work for. What is love? Love is a very simple concept. It's just very challenging to put into your life. In Hebrew, the word ahava has as its root hav. In Aramaic, you see this very clearly. Aramaic and Hebrew are very much related to it. Hav lele intu. Hav means to give. Yahiv, to give. Love is all about giving. That's what makes us fundamentally different from lust, because lust is all about taking. Right? When I love something, I view it as a partner. When I lust something, I view it as an object. Right? Lust is all about me and love is all about you. That's why love grows and lust wanes. And it's very interesting, because the more I give to something, the more I love it. So if you don't love something and you want to love something, if you give to it enough, you will love it. I remember when I went to yeshiva and I so wanted to fall in love with learning, but I didn't love learning. So I decided I was going to take a year, because I had actually met people who did love learning. I'd met people who just enjoyed curling up with a Talmud. I thought that was amazing. I just wanted to see if I could ever get there. So I at least thought it would be a valuable thing to love learning, but I definitely didn't love learning. So it was a lot of struggle. And I spent a good few years, certainly the first year, just struggling with learning and spending an amazing... And one day, it just happened. I just fell in love with learning. And the reason I fell in love with learning was because I put all this energy into learning. You know, you look back at marriage. Marriage is a great example. You know, when you get married... I mean, I got married when I was 25 years old. And I really thought that I found the love of my life and that I loved her. And I look back now, and that was ridiculous. It was ridiculous. How on earth could I know that this was the right person for me? I didn't know what type of a mother she would be. I didn't know anything about her. I mean, we met on a Thursday night at a party, and we were married already, like, I don't know, what was it, 4.5 months later. So I didn't know her at all. It's crazy. And I've spent the last 16 years getting to know her, and I think I'm finally getting there. And anybody who's married more than a few years knows that that's true. My parents are still getting to know each other, and they're almost married 50 years. Because love is all about giving. And by the way, what do? If you're with someone, but you're not in love with them. But you want to be in love with them. You wake up, right? This is the fear of the guy walking down the aisle, right? What if I end up not loving her? It's a ridiculous fear, but it's a real fear, I understand. So if you wake up one morning and you're not in love with your wife, so there's two issues there. One is, how'd you fall out of love? You fell out of love because you stopped loving. Because you stopped giving. You stopped putting into the relationship. If you want to be in love, it's very simple. All you have to do is to love her. Because love is not a noun. Love is a verb. You have to love, which means you have to give. So give and put in. And by the way, loving and giving only really accomplishes great things when it's done in tandem, in balance. A relationship is not a relationship unless there's balance. If we're going to have a relationship, I have to give to you and you have to give back to me. There has to be balance. And it's interesting that on a spiritual level, it's not healthy for the soul to be out of balance. It's not healthy to be given to and not to give back. At a certain point, it corrupts your soul. And it's not healthy to do too much giving. This may be a shock to some of you. Not healthy to do too much giving. You have to give within the range that you're meant to give and not to give too much. Guy comes to your door. He's a beggar. And he wants some stucco. And you just did unbelievably well in the stock market. Unbelievable. So you go into the back room and you give him a $50,000 check. He's like in awe. He runs to the bank because he's sure it's fake. And you think you've just done him the biggest favor of his life, but you probably haven't. Because he didn't earn that. He doesn't know what to do with it. You don't even know what he'll do with it. But what if he comes by the door, right? And he gets to the door and he's a beggar and you've never met him. Oh, I'm so glad you came. I don't know who you are, but I have to move this bookcase. We're cleaning for Pesach. I only have 3 hours. Could you help me move the bookcase? Sure. Comes in. You do all this work. 3 hours. You finally finish. He's sweating. You give him $100. You gave him a lot more than $100. You gave him the ability to give. So he gave you, and you gave him, and his soul is in balance, and that's much healthier. So that's the challenge. Ve'ahavta Hashem Elokecha. Hashem gives me so much. I can never really find a balance, but I have to try. That's the first vehicle to discovering that oneness. So this is an endless discussion, and I hope that this changes the way we relate to the Shema, and the way we relate to the Siddur. And we've basically spent 2 hours discussing pieces of two sentences in an entire Siddur. And it gives you an idea of just how much is in this book. So I hope that this whets your appetite to have some more fun.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990. or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.